KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians, on the web at chcf.org. And URS, a global engineering and construction firm working to improve California's public infrastructure, preserve the state's natural resources, and strengthen the environment. URS.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, a special show focusing on gun violence and how communities around the state are reexamining their relationship with firearms, including a teenage basketball star now adjusting to life in a wheelchair. And we'll hear how the Central Valley is helping former gang members turn away from violence.
Not too many people trying to give you the opportunities when you got gun charges and drug trafficking, involuntary manslaughter on your resume, you know?
Meanwhile, as Sacramento considers new limits on weapons, some gun owners on the North Coast feel under fire.
It is really hard for me to watch a part of the culture that I grew up with and a part of the culture that many people still feel gives them a lot of joy being reviled.
It's the California Report.
Somebody shot.
You think somebody was shot?
Yes. Yes, I heard a gunshot.
Okay. Early Tuesday morning, before the sun was up, a violent rampage was taking place across Orange County. The first victim was a 20-year-old aspiring actress, shot and killed. Within an hour, two others, a 26-year-old construction worker and a 69-year-old man on his way to work, were shot dead before the alleged killer turned the gun on himself. Today, we're devoting our entire show to guns, gun violence, and the wide range of views we have about firearms. In 2011, the most recent year we have data, 1,255 people died from gunshot wounds in California. That's more than three people a day, while many others were wounded, sometimes turning lives and families upside down.
I got a phone call saying that they hate to be the bearer of bad news, that my son had just got shot.
Rochelle Owens Johnson.
So we ran around the corner to see what was happening. It was nothing but yellow tape up. I don't know how many police cars, and yellow tape was everywhere. My son was just laying on the ground bleeding.
It was November 6th, 2011. Rochelle and her family were living in West Oakland at the time. Her son, Kenny Ray, was 14. He'd spent the night with a friend. Walking near his school, two teenagers drove past him. Then, he says, they stopped, backed up, got out, and started shooting.
It happened morning, so I just came from my friend's house, and I was walking home, and then everything happened heck of fast. It was like I was in a movie or something.
And we got there, and I just seen him on the ground, and I just started screaming, telling him I love him. That's all I could do was just telling him I love him.
That's Kenny Ray's older sister, Cassandra. Since that day, her mom says life has never been the same for their family.
I couldn't work anymore. My husband stopped working. And it's been a long journey. It's been a real long journey.
Before he was shot, Kenny Ray was a very good student. And he's proud to say, a star athlete.
It was eighth grade year. I was just really into playing basketball and sports and stuff. I played point guard and power forward. We did good. We won the city champs. High school year, that was going to be my years that I really probably got out there.
But Kenny Ray's basketball days are behind him now. The shooting on that November morning left him paralyzed, unable to walk, much less run and shoot hoops.
Our lives have been just it's like starting all over again. You know, it's trying to nurture a child back to health, and it's like starting all over again. I wouldn't wish this on any family.
For help, the Johnsons turned to social workers at Catholic Charities in Oakland. They do grief counseling with families of murder victims. They also work with so-called non-fatals, like Kenny Ray Johnson, people shot and seriously wounded. Counselor Ricardo Pena.
You start to see how everybody in your home and everybody associated with the person who's been murdered has been affected, so you feel that everybody's been wrong, and that brings up anger.
With inner-city gun violence, Pena says families of the victims and the perpetrators often know each other. And teenagers, he says, whether or not they're directly involved, can develop a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder from constant exposure to the turmoil.
These kids start to internalize and they start to think that this just is normal. It takes something away from the human spirit. You really start to feel a sense of hopelessness and powerlessness.
In the Johnson family's case, there's the extra work of helping Kenny Ray adjust to life in a wheelchair. Pena's co-worker, counselor Javier Arango, understands what Kenny Ray's going through. Arango also uses a wheelchair after being shot 6 years ago.
Most of the time, your back hurts or you're in a lot of nerve pain. That happens when something just messes up with, like, touches your spine. You just be in a lot of pain that medicine can really do nothing for you.
Arango, who came to California from Colombia as a kid, says after his injury, he became bitter and extremely violent.
You know, you go through a lot of ugly things, and then I was, 17 years old, and in a wheelchair with an angry mind. It's very dangerous, you know?
Today, Arango has turned his mind toward helping victims of violence, a change that came, he says, after attending too many funerals.
The most horrible pain, you could see somebody's mother just crying and crying and crying and so many tears and so much pain that just made me quit the life, man.
Arango has helped teach Kenny Ray basic things like how to get in and out of a car. They visit the marina and talk about fishing, how to stay positive and reimagine a life shattered by bullets. In the living room of their new home, Kenny Ray's dad, Big Kenny, explains that he tries to encourage his son despite the crushing loss they all feel.
The hardest part is just that my son can't walk anymore, can't play basketball, can't pursue his dream. That's the hardest part for me.
What do you feel like you can do to help him?
Just let him know I'm here. I'm always be here, and just to let him know that if he doesn't walk again, he can still be successful in life.
With Kenny Ray's hopes of basketball stardom now a dream deferred, his little brother, 11-year-old Kishad, seems to feel the weight of carrying his big brother's hopes on his shoulders now.
Basically, he taught me how to play basketball, him and my dad. So I gotta take it all away now. Like, what he wanna do, I wanna do now.
The family remains hopeful that Kenny Ray will one day walk again. He's able to move his legs a bit and tries to use leg braces, but his full recovery is by no means certain. Meanwhile, he struggles in school and fights off feelings of isolation and frustration at not being able to do the things he loves. His alleged shooters will soon stand trial. I asked his mom what she'd like to say to them if she gets the chance.
I want to know why, you know. I mean, how can they sleep with themselves at night? Just knowing that you just shot somebody that you don't even know or don't know you, it doesn't make any sense. Senseless.
Gun violence isn't just an inner city problem. It's also rampant in the Central Valley, where poverty and high unemployment rates leave some kids turning to life on the streets. One organization in Fresno works to address the issue, but as reporter Alice Daniel found, it's not easy.
That's our take-home pay. Is that for a week or a year?
A month.
A month. It says right there, a month, okay? So that,
Sergio Perez helps young men break their violent ties with gangs, get jobs, and manage their finances. He's a vocational placement counselor at Hope Now for Youth, a Christian organization based in Fresno. Police estimate that Fresno County, which includes many rural towns, has about 24,000 gang members. Marcelino Garcia is one of them. The 20-year-old has been coming to Hope Now for about a month.
Not too many people trying to give you the opportunities when you got gun charges and drug trafficking, involuntary manslaughter on your resume, you know?
He joined a gang when he was 12 and is used to a life of violence. Guns are easy to come by, he says. AK-47s, Glock 40s.
Once you pull a trigger once, man, it's addicting, man. Any little mean mug is like, what? What's up? I'm packing. What do you got? Swing on me. It's cool.
He says he's still fighting with himself over which direction to take. One part of him really wants to do good. The other wants to ride around with a gun and a pocket full of drug money.
They named me what I am, Havoc. They named me Havoc, man, Young Havoc. And Havoc is what I wreak. You know, chaos on people. I came here, though. 2.5 weeks later, bam, my first job.
A minimum wage job as a painter. Counselor Sergio Perez says the ones who change have to want it more than the power and prestige that can come from being in a gang. These young men are often from broken homes, he says. They're lost and lonely, in search of a family. They get their praise and esteem from other gang members for committing violent acts. But some do change. Hope Now has helped more than 1,700 young men find jobs, and most stay on track. Salvador Diaz was one of them. Perez says Diaz came here about 10 years ago. He had served time in the California Youth Authority for armed robbery.
His nickname was Bullet, you know. I mean, he was violent.
He was one of seven children raised by a single mother. He would skip school because other students made fun of him for always wearing the same clothes. He was just a kid when he started running with a Fresno gang called the Bulldogs.
He would not smile. He was just hard, harder than hard. He was just one of these guys that, you know, you look at, he'd just dog you back.
But Diaz grew tired of the streets, tired of looking over his shoulder. He also had three young nephews he wanted to help. He and Perez, who had been homeless as a teenager, became friends. They could identify with each other's past.
Being told, you know, we're nothing, you know, we're thugs, you know, we're just problems. And able to see that, you know what, there's a purpose for us, and that's, you know, we could use all these negative things for good.
At Hope Now for Youth, Perez and others helped Diaz find entry-level jobs, including one as a garbage loader. Last year, Diaz found a job on his own at a Fresno meat processing plant called Apple Valley Farms. It was the last place he would work.
A 32-year-old male employee also received what appeared to be a gunshot wound to the head. That individual was pronounced deceased inside of the business.
A press conference announced the November 6th workplace shooting at Apple Valley that killed Diaz and one other. A disturbed coworker shot them before killing himself.
Salvador's here, and that's my son, and that's my son's dad.
Yesenia Vejar stands in her living room and looks lovingly at a photo of her younger brother. He was a real caretaker, she says. At his funeral, one of his coworkers told Vejar that Diaz wasn't feeling well the day he was shot, but he wouldn't go home.
He said no, that he needed to make money to take care of his nephews.
It was like my dad. I looked up to him like my dad.
13-year-old Juan Alvarez lived with Diaz, his uncle, for 6 years. They played football and basketball. His uncle bought him a bike, but it was later stolen. He says his uncle told him not to follow in his footsteps.
Don't join any gangs like he did, and he stopped for us because you want us to take good care of us?
Diaz's story still resonates with the young men who come through the doors of Hope Now. Marcelina Garcia says he respected Diaz.
My boy wasn't no bullshitter. You know, you want to change, you're going to change. You don't, you're going to leave and go right back to what you were doing.
Then Garcia becomes philosophical. Maybe Diaz fulfilled his purpose in life just by becoming a better person, he says. Maybe his story will help others like him change. Or at least listen. For the California Report, I'm Alice Daniel in Fresno.
As Fresno struggles to keep guns and gangs off the streets, some in the densely forested coastal ranges of Northern California see guns as a means of survival. The California Report's health reporter Mina Kim traveled to Humboldt County to see how calls for tighter gun regulations are going over there.
On the day I meet Humboldt County Sheriff Mike Downey, he's on his way to investigate a site where days before, authorities had uncovered a stash of more than 100 weapons on the property of a man with a criminal record. But Downey says that's rare here.
We have a more freer spirited, self-reliant type of people here. And many of the people in this county are gun owners, and they're responsible gun owners.
The sheriff says there's no way of knowing how many people here own guns, but he has issued 1,500 permits to carry concealed weapons. Recently, he signed on to a national petition opposing President Obama's gun control measures and a directive to Congress to pass laws that would ban military-style assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Downey says he's sworn to uphold the Constitution, and he worries such laws come dangerously close to violating it.
My concern is, if it's the Second Amendment today, is it the First Amendment tomorrow? Is it the Fourth Amendment after that? And where does it stop?
Downey's stance is at odds with the state's urban police chiefs, but then his jurisdiction is mostly rural. And despite a, quote, criminal element that comes with the county's infamous marijuana trade, its yearly homicides tend to run in the single digits. 130,000 people inhabit an area the size of L.A. County, an eclectic mix of artists, hippies, urban transplants, and back-to-the-landers. At Kim Kemp's home, nestled in the rutted slopes of southern Humboldt, farm-fresh eggs fry in a cast-iron pan and homemade biscuits brown in the oven.
Biscuits are the easiest. Sorry. You don't get the fancy breakfast.
After breakfast, Kim, a news blogger, and her husband Kevin, an engineer, sit down to chat. On the table between them is a 12-gauge shotgun, a handgun modeled after a Colt 45, and a remake of a military rifle used in World War II. All three guns are designed to kill people.
We're an hour from law enforcement. If somebody were to try and come into our house, we could not depend on anyone but our neighbors, and even those are at least 10 minutes away. So we would have to defend ourselves.
Kim and Kevin live off the grid. The last 4 miles to their home is dirt road. Solar panels and a generator supply their power, and they collect their own water. If a deer gets tangled in their fence, they're the ones who have to put it down. Kevin picks up the 12-gauge shotgun he's just unloaded and points it at himself.
This end is intimidating. Right? It's big, and it looks big, and it sounds intimidating when you do that. All right, so that's a useful thing for home defense as well.
Kevin hasn't had to kill anyone with it, though he has used it to scare off bears. Using guns safely takes constant practice, he says, which is why he and Kim think the NRA's call to arm schools after the Newtown massacre is extreme.
People are willing to make some reasonable accommodations.
Kim says she'd support a federal law limiting the number of bullets in a clip, and says most of the gun owners she knows would support beefed-up background checks and closing the loophole on private sales by unlicensed dealers at gun shows. And she says gun owners also want to see better access to mental health services.
But when they see people demonize them and they become gun owners become demons, then in turn, in reaction, they get more, I've got to get my guns, I've got to get my ammunition because I won't be able to get them tomorrow.
Kim Kemp says she sees gun owners get cast as stupid, ignorant, mean people.
It is really hard for me to watch a part of the culture that I grew up with and a part of the culture that many people still feel gives them a lot of joy being reviled.
Sitting in a cafe in the town of Garberville, Barbara Kennedy says privately owned firearms make her nervous.
Law enforcement and our army and our armed forces are the ones that are entitled to own guns. And that's it as far as I'm concerned. But of course, that's a very far out opinion.
Kennedy is with the Humboldt County Democratic Central Committee based in Eureka and just helped craft a resolution in support of President Obama's call for bans on assault weapons and high capacity clips. But Humboldt County Sheriff Mike Downey says if those bans come out of Washington, he'd struggle with them, and so would the community. For the California Report, I'm Mina Kim.
After the school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut 2 months ago, school districts across the nation are reexamining their safety procedures, how they practice lockdowns and emergency drills. And Stanislaus County has taken a novel approach. They've made a movie, an ultra-realistic simulation of a school shooting, complete with blood, guns, and frighteningly realistic assailants. Sam Harnett reports.
It's recess at the Hart Ransom K-8 school in Modesto, about an hour and a half east of San Francisco. A group of girls eating at picnic tables peek at us as we walk by, their superintendent, Reem Lockery, and a stranger with a recording device. Lockery is making sure all the gates leading off campus are locked.
A month ago, this probably would have been unlocked. It's unlocked now. It shouldn't be. And I'm glad I checked it. There we go.
Almond orchards and fields surround the Hart Ransom campus. Back before December, the staff didn't lock classroom doors or gates. Visitors could get on campus without going by the main office.
Our safety committee convened right after Newtown, like almost every district safety committee did, and we just tightened up.
At a school a few miles down the road, police are making more dramatic preparations. This audio comes from the Modesto Bee. The footage is of a mock school shooting put on by the Stanislaus County Sheriff's Department.
This is a lockdown. Please lock down. This is lockdown. This is not a drill. This is a lockdown.
It's the nightmare scenario. Two darkly dressed characters are waving guns. Some children run to take cover. Others lie in the grass and concrete with gruesome injuries.
The spinal cord. The sheet metal that came out of her neck.
Yeah.
That's the makeup team from Daydreams and Nightmares, a costume shop brought in for its intensely convincing reproductions of gore.
We actually used real sheet metal because it was last minute they told us.
Police departments and schools have been training regularly for school shootings ever since the 1999 massacre at Columbine High. But now a growing number of schools are making those drills more intense, bringing in actors, props, and professional makeup.
To get the best training value out of anything, you have to make it as realistic as possible. Of course, you can't put yourself in the real-life situation.
Lieutenant Mike Radford directs school response training at the Stanislaus County Sheriff's Department. He decided to intensify the scenario after attending Urban Shield. It's a program that simulates large-scale disasters, like terrorist attacks or earthquakes. To make things more real, Radford got children from a community acting program to sit on the grass at the school and have a picnic. Then, to create a sense of fear, he set off stun grenades.
We got fantastic natural human reaction from these kids. And at the same time, we had a couple of our actors portraying bad guys come out, start yelling and screaming.
With the help of a federal grant, the Sheriff's Department is financing the video as a way to analyze and improve its tactics. The press turned out to cover the event. Clips aired on the Today Show and the BBC. Critics question if publicizing such graphic content might just encourage more violence. But Lieutenant Radford defends the video as a valuable learning tool. So valuable, he wants to expand the simulation in the future.
I learned that as big as we had it, I want it bigger. I want more people involved.
Back at the costume shop, Daydreams and Nightmares, owner Dana Walters' 13-year-old daughter, Jade Rogers, has just come home from school. Rogers played one of the wounded children in the scenario. Her mom says even though she supports the training, it wasn't easy to watch her daughter lie out there with a fake bullet wound to the head.
I was having a really hard time with that, and I'm sitting there going, okay, I know this is fake, but she laid there for 2 hours.
Rogers and her friend say the simulation was more realistic than they expected. Before this, neither had thought much about a school shooting.
Not really. I do now that we did that.
Yeah. But.
Lieutenant Radford hopes to have the video finished before the next school year. He plans to make it available for educators and police forces everywhere. For the California Report, I'm Sam Harnett in Modesto.
You can see that Modesto Bee News video of the training simulation by going to californiareport.org. When Renee Gunter moved to South Los Angeles with her 8-year-old daughter, she didn't realize they were relocating to an area with one of the highest gun violence rates in L.A. But instead of packing up and moving, Gunter decided to bring a sense of community back to her neighborhood. She did it by starting a block party.
I think 2 weeks after my daughter and I moved here, I mean, we heard what I thought, silly me, was firecrackers, you know. And I thought, well, this is weird. It's not the 4th of July. And later we heard sirens. And as it turned out, it was gunshots. And a young 16-year-old kid was killed. And my daughter, she looked at me in disbelief. And she said, why did you move us here? And she goes, well, what if we get shot? And I remember saying to her that she needed to learn how to duck if she heard gunfire drop to the floor. And she was very, very worried. And she goes, I can't go outside. Are you telling me I can't go outside? I can't walk down the street? I said, you can. We'll figure it out. Don't worry. We'll do something. I'll do something. And I was going to do something if I was going to live here, because I had worked so hard to save my money to buy this house that I wasn't going to be chased away by gunfire. After that, I thought, wait a minute. how could I bring this community together? And I thought the best way of bringing a community together and getting people to talk to each other was through food. I passed this flyer around inviting people to come out on the 4th of July and let's have a party. I'll close the streets down and your kids can play and we can get to know each other. I think that there were probably maybe 5 or 6 people that participated. I think the concern was both the fear of something bad happening, like maybe somebody would get hurt or shot, or and also that people really didn't talk to each other. Every year, it got a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger, and it has continued to grow to numbers that I'm a little blown away. 2012, I would say that there were at least 500 people on this street, and it was absolutely spectacular. I mean, there was music, families were sharing their food, kids were riding their bicycles up and down the street, there was water slides, there was basketball, there was disco. I mean, there were at least 200 people dancing in the street. You know, before it seemed like curtains were drawn, it was relatively quiet with the exception of gunshots, the sounds of gunshots too often. We certainly have now turned a corner. I noticed that bars came down off the windows. People did start doing things for each other. I would see neighbors bringing in other neighbors' trash cans. I saw children starting to ride their bicycles up and down the street, even when it wasn't 4th of July. What it means for me is that if I need something, I know that I can go across the street. I can go around the corner. I can ask. I can talk to people. I can sleep at night. I can walk down my street.
Renee Gunter is an artist and community activist living in South Los Angeles. Do you have a community health story to share? Visit californiareport.org to learn more. That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. You can always find us online at californiareport.org. We've got lots of information on California gun laws and statistics. Our director is Susie Racho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. And additional engineering from Paul Ancour and Rob Spate. The online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Guy Marzorati and Gina Shalaba. Our editorial team includes Polly Stryker, Victoria Malione, Ingrid Becker, and Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, celebrating the 2013 recipients of the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards. More information is available at www.irvine.org. The California Endowment, health happens in schools, at calendow.org. And Chevron, committed to helping California grow by supporting small businesses and investing in education. More information available at chevron.com.